From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1999 with a Supreme Court decision. The court decided that, quote, unjustified segregation of persons with disabilities constitutes discrimination, end quote. That sparked a wave of changes that are still being felt today. New York State redesigned Medicaid transportation, for example. The legislature introduced bills to coordinate service transportation for developmentally disabled persons. And don't be fooled, by the way, into thinking this impacts a small segment of the population when we use the term disability. More than half of people over the age of 75 in this state have a disability of some kind. A third of people over 65 have a disability. This week, we've been hosting the Dialogue on Disability, and today we're looking at access. This impacts your neighbors, probably someone in your family. Might even impact you. My guest for the hour will tell us about access and some of the things that are happening in our community. Bill McDonald's here, the Executive Director of Medical Motor Service. Bill, nice to see you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Dee Mascari is here. Dee is the Programs and Services Director for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society of the Upstate New York Chapter. Dee, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Also here is Sarah Taylor, the Director of Unemployment for Rochester Rehabilitation. Sarah, nice to see you.
Thank you.
And Ruth Redman is here. She is, a program participant with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, and I guess in several different ways, going back to your diagnosis in 1997. Is that right?
That's right.
What did you know in 1997 when you were diagnosed with MS?
What
did you know about MS, I should say?
What did I know about MS? Very, very little.
And that would make you probably very, very common for people who end up diagnosed with MS. But, you know, we're going to talk as we go throughout this hour about the different populations, even within MS, in terms of when a diagnosis happens and what it means for you. What do you remember thinking when you got the diagnosis?
I remember thinking, why me? And immediately the thought came to me, why not me? You know, what makes me so different that I wouldn't be diagnosed with a disease like that?
That's actually a sort of a rather admirable position. I think the why me lasts for maybe a little bit longer than that for most people. But I imagine at that point you start learning about what it is that you have and what you're going to do, right?
That's right.
And tell me what started to change or what, you know, as you sort of surveyed the landscape of living with MS, what was that like?
Well, there's so much uncertainty with MS. It's different for every person. And it's difficult, if not impossible, to predict what the course of the disease is going to be like. I think as we've made inroads in research, neurologists can maybe predict a little bit better from people's symptoms how things are going to go. But at least back then, they weren't willing to say, well, you know, we think this is going to go this way. So there's no real prognosis. At least there wasn't for me. So I didn't know. It was fear of the unknown. What's going to happen? Am I going to get up tomorrow morning and not be able to get out of bed? Am I going to be able to take care of my little ones? I just didn't know. There was just so much unknown.
And I remember having a friend with someone who was in the middle of diagnosis, and the question, as you say, all these questions come up, but certainly the question becomes, can I continue working the way I've been working? You know, is my employer going to be helpful with it? Am I going to be able to have that kind of access? That comes up, I imagine, pretty quickly.
Sure. I was a stay-at-home mom at the time, mm-hmm. and my question was, can we continue having children?
Yeah. Because you had a child at the time, it was one?
We had two children at the time. And so one was 7, mm-hmm. and our other little girl was 1 year old.
1 year old.
And we had a foster child also living with us, a 17-year-old girl. So we had a house full.
And you start thinking, did your brain take you into all of the ways that you're concerned? I mean, one year old is tough. One year old is a great age, but very different than having a 17-year-old, let alone having both in the house at the same time.
Absolutely,
you have to be able to do a lot.
Sure.
And what did you start to find out at the time? And I wonder. We're going to talk to Dee in a moment, and I wonder if 1997 is very different than 2015 in terms of, you know, what was out there and helpful. But what did you find out, Ruth?
As far as what?
As far as sort of understanding how you were going to adapt and what was going to help you adapt.
Well, one thing that was very helpful was having a social worker from the MS Society come out to our house and explain, not just to me, but to our little family, what it was all about, and really arming us with a lot of information. As far as adapting, I didn't know what I was adapting to yet. I had been living with all these symptoms for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. We're guessing, just looking back, that I've probably had this at least since high school.
Wow.
So it really explained a lot of things. I remember while we were seeking a diagnosis, the neurologist asked me to write down every symptom, every complaint of any kind, you know, physical complaint that I've had. And I felt a little bit like a hypochondriac. I'd never actually verbalized any of these. And so I wrote all these things down. Every single thing on the list was an MS symptom.
Do you remember some of those things?
Sure. A tingling, numbness in the hands and feet. One famous one for me is this creepy crawly feeling that's on mm-hmm. the surface of the skin, the scalp. Extreme fatigue at times. That was a big one. So those were the ones that stood out.
And so over the years, as those things were happening, what did you chalk them up to before you had a diagnosis?
I ignored them.
Just ignored them?
I really pretty much did. I tend to be a doer. I want to just plow ahead and get things done.
And did you think, I've got tingling or numbness or, that creepy crawly feeling, but maybe I'm itchy, maybe I'm cold, maybe it's something, do you rationalize it in those ways?
I rationalized it. And the thing that drove me to get medical attention was waking up one morning with half my face numb. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's kind of weird. And it went away, and I was busy chasing this one-year-old around and trying to get things done. And I forgot about it. But the next day it happened again, and I thought, okay, this is not normal. Because I thought, I slept wrong on my face. How do you sleep on
sure,
your face wrong? You don't. That's ridiculous. And so I went to the doctor immediately, and he said, well, you need to go see a neurologist. So it was at that point that I, with that odd sensory thing that I saw.
Let me tell you where I really, really relate to you, Ruth, and this hour is not at all about me. But I when I was growing up, especially in high school and post high school, I was moderately athletic. I mean, I wasn't a great athlete, but I played sports and games. And I would have tachycardia arrhythmias. So my heart rate would go from 80 beats a minute to 240 instantly. And I always thought growing up, well, that's what happens when you're working out. That's what happens when you're playing sports, right? And you don't want to stop what you're doing. You either, or maybe you stop for a couple of minutes. But you don't want to. I didn't want to ask. I thought that was bothersome. I thought it was probably normal. I rationalized it until my legs went out from under me on a basketball court one day, and we got a diagnosis, and I had a non-open heart surgery, and they took care of it. But it took a while to sort of confront it that way. And it sounds to me, where I relate to you, is all those things that you tell yourself, maybe I slept on my face wrong. maybe it's this or that. Because number one, you don't know what MS is. But number two, you're a busy person. You don't want to have to try to derail for a minute and
sure.
confront that. So was it a relief to get a diagnosis in any way?
Yes,
it
absolutely.
It was.
I'm glad I got a diagnosis fairly quickly. In fact, my neurologist did something quite unconventional, but I'm really thankful to him that he did. When he had figured out that it was MS, he was getting ready to go away on a trip, and he couldn't get a hold of me. So he actually left my diagnosis on my voicemail, which, that's probably not done. but he knew I wanted to know one way or another, is it or isn't it? And so I was glad. I actually played that recording several times just to let it sink in, and I'm glad.
Now, Dee, I have to think that Ruth's experience is somewhat common, the notion of sort of if we don't know what MS is, that we may have those symptoms and they may sort of manifest for a while without getting a diagnosis, yeah?
Very common, and actually before the MRI, a lot of people went years and years, decades, without knowing what was wrong with them.
Those symptoms she described, very common as well?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so What do you say to people, Dee, who are diagnosed, again, into adulthood? I mean, a diagnosis is different at sort of a lot of different ages, but a lot of people who get a diagnosis, they don't want to stop what they're doing. They don't want to have to, they're going to have to make some changes maybe in their lives, but they don't want to feel like it's going to derail work, family, all of those other obligations.
And it shouldn't have to. I mean, we should be able to work with a person and keep them working if that's what they want to and are able to do. You know, the two biggest things that keep people from working are the extreme fatigue, and then some people do have cognitive issues due to MS. But, you know, there's a lot of really good programs out there that can help people work around those things. We can help put in some safety nets so that the person maybe can work part-time, different things like that. But it is hard, you know, because you have to have an employer that's understanding that you don't know what's going to happen day to day. You may, you know, wake up one morning and not be able to do the things that you could do the day before.
Forgive my ignorance, Ruth and Dee, but let me ask, and I should know, having talked to you, especially Dee, we've talked before, but again, sometimes if you don't have a condition or a disability, you sort of lose that sense of depth of knowledge on it. And what I don't know is, does MS worsen in any sort of way? Is it sort of stagnant in the adult population? In other words, if you have MS, are the symptoms essentially going to be the same? Will they get worse? Can they be mitigated?
It changes.
It does
change.
That's
the issue. There's different types of MS. Most people have an MS that has like a baseline symptom, and then they have an exacerbation, and then they go back to their baseline, and then they may be fine for a while, and then they have another exacerbation. Some people have a more progressive form where it's kind of a slow decline, increasing symptoms. It's different for each person, and that's what makes it so hard.
Ruth, your symptoms, any increase over the years?
Oh, sure.
Yeah?
Sure. I've been fortunate, though, that the therapy that I'm on has really slowed down the progression of the disease. And so I'm very thankful for that.
What are the ways that either therapy, treatment has changed from your diagnosis 18 years ago to today?
I think there are just so many more choices, right, Dee?
Yes.
So I think maybe there were half a dozen, if that, choices when I was diagnosed, mostly in the way of injections, like the Copaxone that I'm presently on. Now there are oral medications and all kinds of different things, infusions that are available to people.
The oral medications are a new breakthrough, and they help some people. Other people do better on the injections, but it is an option, especially for people that really have a block against the injections or have issues with injection site or things like that. They can go on the oral medications if, you know, the doctor deems it's right for them.
It's our dialogue on disability, and we're talking about access for everyone and the various services in our community to make sure people with ability and various disabilities do have access. And we mean transportation, we mean access to work if they want to, et cetera. In the moment, we're going to talk to Bill McDonald from Medical Motor Service about that. Sarah Taylor's here from Rochester Rehabilitation. But Dee, when it comes to MS specifically, if someone is working and that is a job that's not at home, is there an immediate barrier or potential issue that could arise for someone with MS to have access to work?
There could be. If they're having trouble driving, we do send a lot of people to Rochester Rehab for their driving program, adaptations to their cars. If they get to the point where maybe just driving is not an issue, then having to rely on buses or RTS access, or, you know, and that doesn't cover the whole county. So there's a lot of people that are outside of the service area that have a hard time getting to where they need to go.
What kind of adaptations to a vehicle?
Hand controls, lifts for a wheelchair, you know, those types of things. And they're expensive. They're very expensive, and, you know, finding funding for those.
Is there help to pay for these? Let's start with vehicles. You need help with the vehicle. Is there help?
There is. There are a lot of programs out there, including our financial assistance can help some. But that's a lot of what we do with service management, care management, working with people to get the resources that they need so that they can purchase these items.
Rochester Rehabilitation works with as many as 4,000 people, say, in a year, and from MS to across the spectrum. But, Sarah, give me sort of a broad outline of what Rochester Rehabilitation does.
Well, Rochester Rehabilitation Center offers an array of services, from mental health services, employment services, SportsNet. We heard about drive-on services, as well as our one-source solutions outsourcing for business entities. And our overall organization mission is work, wellness, and independence. And our goal is to keep individuals in the communities, in their homes, the ability to work, the ability to have a social life, just to maintain their independence and to be self-sufficiency. Dee mentioned funding for adaptation for drivers programs. Well, there's a number of programs that we work with, particularly to help people maintain and obtain employment. So if someone was diagnosed with MS and was employed or looking for employment, there are programs that we can connect them to. Access VR is a state-funded program, formerly known as VESID, that would help them obtain driver's license that could be covered by state and grant funding that can help them with the adaptation with a new diagnosis. And as it relates to employment services, there's a lot of misconceptions about employing individuals with disabilities. What is that going to look like for the workforce? Well, inclusion is important. And every individual has a right that wants to work, should have the opportunity to work. And one of our goals is to prepare individuals for employment, regardless of what their ability or limitations are, to help them with soft skills such as interviewing, communicating in the workplace. It may be learning basic computer skills. We most recently partnered with a couple financial institutions locally and held a bank teller training program. And through that program, the banks approached us and basically said, we want to diversify our workforce. So we held a training for 10 weeks preparing individuals to work in that field as well as customer service. We are embarking upon a collections training, so really preparing individuals for competitive work, whether it's healthcare industry or a manufacturer. Our goal is to prepare a workforce that is strong.
With thousands of people a year, you see people across the age spectrum, I assume. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As young as?
17 in employment services. Most of our services at Rochester Rehabilitation Center is for adults 18 and older. We are taking on new initiatives to work with youth who are transitioning from school age to adults around employment services. A number of youth who are in high schools that have some type of learning disability or a physical disability that's graduating from high school may look for, what am I going to do next? Can I work? Should I go to school? So we are going to offer a spring break program, which is April recess, March 28th through April 3rd, to work with individuals graduating from high school who may be looking at the next steps. What do I do? I have a disability. Can I work? I want to go to college. How do I make that happen? So again, all ages from 17 to 65, we see in all of our services, from mental health to drivers training, as well as employment services.
And you talk about mental health. What can the difference be between someone who has had a disability for their entire life versus someone who is an adult. Not everyone is like Ruth, and you handle MS the way she did, which mm-hmm. sounds really remarkable. It can be daunting for people to find out that they're going to be dealing with a new kind of challenge.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between someone who has grown up with a disability versus an adult who has to sort of learn to adapt to it?
Well, I think as society, things have changed. Socially, we have changed with social media. Economically, things have changed. And I think, you know, acquiring a disability as an adult can also be very challenging. We work with individuals from, you know, low income to a higher income. And someone, to give you an example, may have been laid off from a job and has been home with depression, lost. They're going to lose their home due to the income change. They are feeling depressed, don't want to lose the home. They're used to a certain lifestyle. And here they are at 50 years old and their whole life has changed. So what are they going to do next? So I think with a number of our services, such as mental health, working with someone through therapeutic intervention, letting them know there is hope, and referring to other services within the L. Siegel Family Agency, letting them know that you can get help for MS, you can get assistance with transportation, and you can get assistance with employment, is often a great benefit for the older adult.
Before I get over to the phones, Mark writes to the program and says he's been dealing with depression for many years. Shouldn't depression be more respected as an actual disability?
The range of depression diagnoses really are pretty broad. I think when it comes to mental illness and stigmas in society, they're often looked at different than physical disabilities. Often people are blamed for mental illness when it is actually, it's a medical condition. And we should, as a society, look at it differently. I think we have come a long way, and we know that we promote recovery, that someone may be suffering from mental illness, but there are opportunities for them to live a full life and to have a life that they can fully function and, you know, give back to society, as well as enjoy recreational opportunities and social life.
You know, I think of people in my own life with depression, and I think, to Mark's point, I think about let's say you've got someone with a physical disability, let's say they need a wheelchair to move around.
Mm-hmm.
They can't, if they just decide one day, I'm not going to use the wheelchair, they may not be successful in moving around.
Mm-hmm.
If someone has depression and they're on medication, unfortunately, I've met plenty of people, and I understand the psychological, the mentality that comes up where they say, I've been good for a while. I don't need the meds. Meds are a sign of weakness.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we know that's not true. But then I've seen people get off medication and they feel paralyzed. They stop going to work. They may lose a client. They may lose a job. So anyway, to Mark's point there, it's not my expertise, but I understand the sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
Fair enough?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let me get to the phones. This is Bernard who wants to join the conversation. Go ahead, Bernard.
Hi. Thanks for the conversation. I guess I have a problem with this term disability. I view it as being a challenge, not necessarily a disability. And I also think that there are some real benefits to dealing with these challenges. My wife has worked with quote-unquote disabled people for a long time, and one of the things that I noticed is they are very committed to the jobs that they have and to the lives that they have. Yeah, they're more complex than most people's are, but they're also, they take on a different view of life, and that view can be very positive and very contribute to what's going on in your life. I was designated as going blind in the 86, and I have done computer projects all over the world, England, Asia, Canada, et cetera, et cetera. And as a blind person or going blind person, one of the things that I noticed is I was focused because, you know, I had to focus, but I did focus and I was successful. And so I just basically have a problem with when you go to hire, and I have hired, when you go to hire disabled people, everybody focuses on the disabled and they don't focus on the positive. And yes, there are challenges, but at the end of the day, believe me, you feel very good that you have helped somebody out who's got a lot of capabilities, even though they have some challenges. All right. So anyway, thank you very much for this.
Bernard, thank you. Now, you got plenty of nods around the table. I'm going to start with Sarah, but we'll ask the panel. What do you think?
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. One of the things when we're working with employers and advocating and educating them about our programs, we focus on individual strength. We focus on the skill set and the strengths that they bring to the organization. We don't go in talking about someone's disability or inability or ability. We focus on how can we match an individual up with this job and the skill sets that's needed to perform the job.
But it sounds to me like he wants us to stop using the word disability altogether. And I understand the sentiment. Mm.
Absolutely. There's a lot of dialogue around the country.
I agree so much with the caller as well in terms of the use of labels that we do. And I think in the Siegel Center community, there's been a movement away from using that word and focus more on abilities, as has been mentioned. Because really, when you get down to it, it's you could define probably 99% of the population as having some kind of disability. And I won't bore you with mine, but I mean, there's plenty of them out there. And I think we have to focus on what people can do rather than what they can't do.
Yeah, it sounds to me like Bernard is saying that once we start obsessing on that label, we are maybe even unconsciously limiting what we our own expectations.
We sure are.
Sort of the poverty of low expectations,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
Okay, well, let's do this. Let's take a 60-second break here, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hear more about not only services that are available, but frankly, transport services, the things that Medical Motor Service does, the things that are available to make sure that you know that if you end up technically with a disability, and I apologize, Bernard, but I understand the point. If you don't like that label, but if whatever you want to call it, you don't have to let it necessarily limit you, and that's part of the point. We're talking about access, and today's Connections is part of Dialogue on Disability Week. It's a partnership between WXXI and the Al Siegel Community of Agencies in conjunction with the Herman and Margaret Schwartz Community Series. Dialogue on Disability is supported in part by the Golisano Foundation with additional support from the Fred L. Emerson Foundation. I'm Evan Dawson. Short break, and more with you next on Connections.
Passengers can get bumped from airline flights, and cargo can too.
Things that are going to end up in our stores, electronics, their clothes, their livestock.
Your extra bag in the cargo hold might mean that some freight won't fly.
People go first. Freight goes last, even fresh food.
Airline cargo economics and your baggage fees today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
On the next Morning Edition, school's obsession with standardized tests is starting to feel really old-fashioned.
Businesses in the 1970s used to have to shut down and do inventory for 3 weeks. And that's kind of how we do it in schools today. We spend 8 days taking tests.
The question is, what's the alternative? I'm Steve Inskeep. Possibly better ways to measure school performance on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning at 5 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Bill McDonald is the Executive Director of Medical Motor Service, and he sent over a very handy sort of layout of a picture of our community. And those some of the numbers you sent over, Bill, remind us just that when we hear that word disability again, sometimes we automatically think, well, it's not me. I don't have a disability, so it's probably a small portion of the population. And you know, so again, if you missed it at the top of the hour, I want to mention that 52% of people over the age of 75 in this state have at least one disability. A third of people over the age of 65 in this county have at least one disability. And we're talking a good amount of them with an ambulatory disability. 15% have trouble leaving the home. And, you know, someone who is disabled is four times more likely to have transportation barriers. So we're not talking about a small section. We're talking about our neighbors and people in our family.
Right. We're talking about tens of thousands of people. And one of the things at Medical Motor Service is that we work with all different age groups, all kinds of issues, both medical, behavioral issues, and so on. And it's very interesting. There's been two, you know, we really talk about access. There's been two studies, if you will, that give some insight into this. The Robert Woods Johnson Foundation in 2011 asked physicians if they could write a prescription to improve health outcomes for the population, what would they write the prescription for? And 85% of them said they would be for three things that they can't write prescriptions for, and that would be transportation and access to health care. It would be for nutritional food, and it would be for fitness. So three things that people can do the most or need the most to overcome to have better health outcomes. And the Finger Lakes Health System Agency just last year did surveys and focus groups to look at what are the barriers to health care in this community as they work very closely with Rochester Regional Health System and Strong on a big project for Medicaid reform. And what they found was transportation was the number one barrier to care. Like 25% of the respondents said that transportation was a barrier. And it's a barrier for women who are pregnant and can't get to food sources or get to prenatal care or even after their child is born, get them to pediatric care. It's a problem for people that are discharged from hospitals in this community and need follow-up visits to their physician, or they need to get a prescription. It's the misuse of emergency rooms where people either walk or call an ambulance to go to an emergency room for primary care because they don't have another transportation source to go to an urgent care center or to a primary care physician. So there are lots of ways in which access, fundamental access of transportation, and it doesn't matter whether you're in the city of Rochester where we have good access to public transit, or you're in a rural area because the problems are the same in terms of access. They found that mothers in the rural communities in this project identified transportation as a barrier, 9 out of 12 of them. So we have to find some ways to be creative about providing more access to health care.
I think there's an assumption, though, that if you're in a rural area, and plenty of our listening audience is not in an urban area, that it is going to be much more difficult.
It is going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult because of the distances involved. It's going to be difficult because of the lack of resources that are out there, just in terms of companies that provide transportation and, in some cases, public transportation. So it has those challenges. But it has challenges in the city as well. There's stories, you know, of mothers that have several children, need to get them to the pediatrician or go shopping. That taking the public bus is a barrier for them. Just managing that is difficult for people. So it shows its face in many different ways, but yes, it's a significant issue. And some of the solutions have to be different as well. But all of the solutions come to how can we better coordinate services so that people can get access? How can we take all these vehicles that you see around town and work to increase the capacity of those vehicles to help people get to jobs? I mean, we're doing some job, you know, we talked about employment. We do a limited amount of that with the Hillside Work Scholarship Program, where there's young people who need to get to work out and live in the city and have to go to Brockport or Webster or Parrington. So that's what I love about what we do at Medical Motor Service, because we serve 15,000 people a year, 560,000 trips, in many, many different ways, not just to healthcare, but also to community services.
Yeah, what 7 out of 10 trips that you make are not for medical reasons.
That's right. That's right.
And so now we're looking at the many different ways. Again, almost 600,000 one-way trips a year that you're doing. But, you know, again, I'm going to get to a caller in a second whose biggest issue is transportation.
Yeah.
And for the people listening, maybe you're thinking of a family member. Maybe you're thinking of a relative or a friend. Maybe it'll be you someday. There's going to be concern about how do I pay for this?
Right.
And medical motor service, for example, you know, people will say, how do I get access to it and how do I afford it?
Right. You know, we have these systems that have been created that are very categorical, and there are silos of funding and trying to cross over those. For example, if you're a poor person, and that's a growing segment of our population, and you don't have a car and you can't drive, it's very hard to get around. I mean, you might be able to take the bus to some things, but your doctor may not be on a bus line. You might be able to take program X if you fall into some sort of definition, but not program Y because you don't meet those requirements. And if you pay it privately, it's expensive. Even our programs that are subsidized by the United Way for individuals unaffiliated with a program that just have to get somewhere, it still costs money. So transportation is very expensive, and that's one of the reasons why we have to try to coordinate it better to offset those costs.
You've got 140 vehicles for medical motor service. Could you grow? Are you trying to grow? Does the community need you to grow?
Well, yes to all of those. I think one of the projects we're engaged in right now is, instead of just saying, well, let's add more vehicles, we're collaborating with three other human service agencies to say, okay, of all of these vehicles that you have, and there's about 180 other vehicles out there, can we put them into a, this is my technical explanation, can we put them into a big pot, stir it up, and create routing and scheduling and ride sharing to increase the capacity and service? Now, you would think, gee, that's a pretty simplistic common sense solution. It's taken us years to get to that point, and even now to get certain waivers from the state in terms of how can we do this in an efficient way and the software that you need for it. But so the answer is, first, I think we have to look at what do we have in this community and how can we better use it. And then secondly, we have to work with funders to target groups that need transportation and provide a way to subsidize that and pay for that if we can.
All right, let me get Jane in because Jane's a regular caller of this program, and this hits home for her. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, I think that is my number one problem is transportation, and I use every possible means. I used to take the bus quite a bit. I take cabs, and I've tried the Medicaid, and one of the drivers told me with the Medicaid that when he was over an hour late, that they do not promise to get you there on time. They just promise to get you there. And when you have a doctor's appointment, that embarrasses me terribly to come to a doctor's appointment late. And also around the town we have, I don't know what the problem is, but we don't have enough benches. And when I do get out, it's on one of my better days, and I have limited energy. And by the time I get there, wherever I'm going, I'm exhausted. And that doesn't seem to be taken into consideration with the disabled that we do have frequently a lot of fatigue getting out, and we're treated as though we're able-bodied, that we're just like everybody else, and that we can wait. And so I just jumble up all of my different means of getting around and tip heavily and hope. Thank you.
Jane, thanks for the call.
That's an excellent example of how creative people have to be to use multiple means to get around. You know, we talked about a year ago on this program about livable communities,
yep.
and your reference to having park benches is a prime example of that, where we need to build into livable communities that those rest stops, you know, accessible sidewalks, better signage, and so on. So it's more than just vehicles; it's also how do we make our communities better to get around in. And your reference to Medicaid, you know, one of the frustrations and one of the work that this new project that the health systems is working on is if you're on Medicaid, you can get payment to go to the doctor, but you can't get payment to go get a prescription. You can't get payment, you can't get transportation to go to an AA meeting or a support group, or if you're a pregnant woman at risk and you need to get food, you can't get transportation to get food. So we don't look at things in terms of the whole person's need for better health outcomes. And that's one of the efforts that's underway as well in this community now. We have this world of acronyms, and DSRIP is one of them, but creating a new delivery system and reforming the delivery system of Medicaid to look at how can we get waivers to provide services that are more holistic. Because remember, those doctors would write a prescription, get food, you know, get exercise,
get access. A question from a listener for Bill is, has Medical Motor Services given any thought to going with a Lyft or Uber style business model in a nonprofit aspect?
Well, we are a nonprofit. I can guarantee you that if you look at our P&L. I applaud all of those alternative transportation models. So, for example, our belief is we need to have a rich variety of community transportation options. That may not be the medical motor service business model per se, because of lots of regulations and lots of issues we have to deal with. But I applaud those kinds of flexible systems. I mean, and that gets to Jane's earlier call. I mean, she may be out partying some night. I'm not saying that Jane goes out and parties at night, but she may have to call a taxi or an Uber to get home. We know plenty of people that do that. But to get to work, it might be something different. To get to the doctor, it might be something different. So we haven't looked at, that's not our business model, but I think creating more options for people is important.
We're talking about access, and for people with disabilities and different challenges, as Bernard pointed out, people with different physical, maybe neurological or psychological challenges in this community, there is a growing sort of level of access. And let me ask, for our listeners who are just joining us, let me ask Ruth Redman a question again. Ruth is someone who was diagnosed in 1997 with MS, and MS hits people in different ways. What are the kind of services that you do need now?
What kind of services do I need now? I'm not sure. I'm not sure I have an answer to your question.
Now, what kind of programs have been sort of, are you kind of either needed over the years, or what's the kind of application to someone like you who've been living with MS for 18 years?
Tough question. I think at one point it would have been helpful to have some information about exercise. And that's something that's become very important in my life the last 5 years, because I've made some major changes in my life in that way. And I was really afraid of the whole exercise thing, because often people with MS have an increase in symptoms when they get overheated. And so that was some territory that was uncharted for me for a while, and I delved into it slowly.
And how's it going?
It's going great. I'm now a group exercise instructor for the YMCA, and I teach spin classes at the Westside Y. And so, yeah, my life has changed completely in that respect.
I love it. Teaching spin now. You've gone from over 5 years concerned about how it's going to impact you with MS to teach in spin classes.
That's right.
And I know there are MS bike events as well that I think are coming in the summer. Have you been involved with that?
Yes, I have for 4 years have been involved with Bike MS. Always wanted to do something, always looking for opportunities to be able to give back to the MS Society in one way or another. Be it participating in some kind of research, or I always wanted to do a Walk MS event, and it just never worked out with our family schedule. And as I was getting healthier with exercise and changing my diet completely, and got healthier and lost a ton of weight, I thought, well, maybe I can do a Bike MS. I got involved in spin classes and really enjoyed it. And that got me started.
Dee, if people want to check out either Bike MS or other things, where can they go to kind of get started?
They can either call us, 800-344-4867, or they can go on our website, msupstateny.org.
Let me get back to the phone, so more questions from listeners. And this is Liz in Rochester. Go ahead, Liz.
Yeah, this relates to a previous caller. It's about getting people to and from the store, and then getting them up, like Liz Lang, take you to a store, but they won't help you up steps, and I have 22 steps to go up and a bad back. And the same thing, you know, if you can't afford to pay medical motors or the cab to take you to and from, what can they do about that? How can they get stores to do deliveries? I know in New York City, it's more for a doctor's appointment, but they did give you cab voucher if they can't get a van to you for some reason. And then they reimburse you for the cab with the exception of a tip. I used to live in New York City. It's very frustrating if you don't have someone or any family up here to help you go shopping. It's very, very difficult and very expensive.
Thank you for the call, Liz. Bill, want to jump in there?
Right. I agree with you. I want to put in a little plug here for Wegmans, and this isn't to do a commercial, but they actually provide a grocery shopping shuttle through Medical Motor Service that is no charge to people, and you can get information about that on the web, on their website or on our website. We go to over 65 locations to pick up people, to take them on a pre-scheduled basis as a shuttle. But that doesn't address your issue if you live in a home by yourself or with a family and you have lots of stairs. There are programs out there that you can contact depending on your age. Again, we get into this categorical chimney thing. You know, a Catholic Family Center has a program called the STAR program that provides higher level of assistance.
But they, you know, they can only take you to one store, and I understand that. But it's also, and they can only spend so much time.
Yeah.
But it's also the fact that if you can't afford Wegmans and you want to go to Price Right, what do you do?
Right. That is a one of the things that we have identified as a problem, which is getting people to get groceries, getting them to get prescriptions.
Right, because they won't step off and pick up a script for you if you're on your way home.
Correct.
And
Liz,
can't drop
Liz, let me just jump in and say again, every person's different, and some people can afford Wegmans versus Hartz Grocers, which is new, versus others. Hartz, I saw on Twitter today, Hartz is offering delivery.
There you go.
And again, I'm not saying everyone is in the exact same category, but but hopefully that's the kind of thing that will help.
Right, and through some of the senior center programs, there are shopping to alternative like Tops and Price Right. We take people to those stores as well, but again, that's in a different program. So everything's got its little set of rules, and that's why we need a broader community transportation.
Right, or getting the stores to get together to figure out some type of. Like Fresh Direct in New York City. You know, there's got to be some way of being able to do that. Again, it's not New York City, so it's harder. It's not even where you can order it over the phone like I used to do in the city, and they would deliver it.
Right.
And they didn't charge you for delivery where normally they do, but in a situation I am blind. And so they didn't, under those conditions, they did not charge.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, thanks for the call. I hope a year from now we're talking about a more comprehensive and sort of single umbrella. Does everybody sort of agree that that would be a good direction to go? Because that's been one of the themes this hour, is there are a lot of things available, but sometimes it's hard to know how are you eligible, or who is sort of in charge. And so maybe that's a – I think that's a fair point there. One more quick call. This is Caroline in Rochester. Go ahead, Caroline.
Yes, I'm wondering how the new reorganization of RTS and reducing the number of bus stops may have affected the handicapped people. A few years ago, they drew their circle a little smaller, and people who lived in handicapped communities who had moved there so they could go to work and have access were cut right out of the loop. So has anyone heard how much handicapped people have been affected by this reduction of bus stops?
Well, can't quantify it, but when they cut the fixed route service, they cut the alternative service. It used to be called Liftline, now it's called Access. So your point is well taken. The two are connected, and it does reduce service.
All right, Caroline, thank you for the call. I've got about a minute left here. Let me go around the room. Bill, some final thoughts from our panel, especially about what you want people to know about what is available, what's out there from your perspective. Bill?
Well, there's a lot of transportation services out there. You can go to our website, medicalmotors.org, and get some ideas about that. But I think we need to work, as you said, on a mobility management approach to things to be more coordinated in our service delivery.
Is it likely that that's happening?
I think there's hope for that.
Yeah.
I do have hope for that, and I think we have the beginnings of that in some projects. It's slower than we'd like, though.
Dee?
I think that the National MS Society is a good place to start. We can connect you with services. We can help you navigate a lot of systems and figure out where to go for things that you need if it's not us.
Especially if you feel overwhelmed at the beginning.
Correct.
I guess we've talked about this before, but
It's okay to feel that way at first, isn't it?
It's fine, and we have lots of programs for people who are newly diagnosed, probably many more than they had, Ruth, when you started out. We have exercise programs, different things like that, that we evolve as people's needs evolve.
Sarah?
Rochester Rehabilitation Center is available, whether it's a mental health diagnosis, someone looking for employment services, or needing assistance learning how to drive with a newly physical diagnosis.
And Ruth, just a last quick thought from you. You seem to be doing great, and I think you're just a great example of what life with MS can be. It looks from my point of view.
Yes, it's very diverse. It doesn't look like one, you know, one particular person looks
sure.
very different from another. And I'm grateful to be here, and I'm thankful that things have gone the way they have for me. I thank God.
I want to take one of your spin classes.
Friday mornings, you're on.
Thanks to a great panel for this dialogue on disability, a partnership with the Al Siegel community of agencies, and our thanks, of course, as well to the many different branches that support the dialogue on disability, whether it's the Margaret and Herman, the Herman and Margaret Schwartz Community Series, it's the Golisano Foundation, it's the Fred L. Emerson Foundation. Great stuff this week. Thanks, everyone. Short break, and we're getting ready for the State of the State next.